The fake news wars that we're experiencing right now are not going to end soon.
Terry Mattingly on his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, making the case for news discernment.
We're actually seeing a war to define what is and what isn't news. This whole thing is about the purpose of journalism and whether the classic American model of the press, with its whole emphasis on balance and fairness, is going to survive the internet age. What we'll be talking about is where savvy readers can go to get their news. We're also going to ask, what happens to American public discourse if we all keep on clicking on news sources that only tell us what we want to hear?
You can meet and hear Terry Mattingly June 9th and 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385.
We don't treat religion like a subject that we think influences the news and what influences what happens in the world.
The God of Islam wants us to die for him. Jesus died for us.
A conscience that's bound to anything other than God's word is enslaved to idolatry.
When we do our own thing as a congregation, ignoring history, ignoring the divine liturgy's history and so forth, we have in a sense become an island unto itself.
Topics you can really sink your teeth into. That's why Iowa dentists love Issues Etc.
I don't think it's a unique story. In fact, I think it's a story that may be far more common. One told recently on the pages of the New York Times in a column titled No Room for Dissent in Women's Movement Today, many women who started out as either part of the women's movement or fellow travelers with it, concerned about things like equal pay and laws that were, well, positively anachronistic when it came to women in their place in society and our legal system or political system as well, wanting to see women brought into the, well, at the time it would have been the 20th century, from the suffragettes in the early part of that century all the way through the mid-century. But something changed. Something changed in the women's movement. For instance, why is it now all about abortion? 40 plus years after abortion was legalized, it's still all about abortion. Something has changed in feminism or the women's movement post-millennium. We'll talk about it here on Issues Etc. Live this Tuesday afternoon, April the 4th. Greetings and welcome. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Cleta Mitchell will join us here for the better part of this first hour to talk about post-millennium feminism. Then Cheryl Magnus will be our guest. We're going to talk about two issues. Practicing the Benedict option. She says she and her family have done it for 20 years without even knowing it, and it's paid off. And also talking to her about some practical steps preparing you and your family for the Easter celebration. Pastor Hans Feeney will be our guest. We're going to talk about the truth about male and female friendships. He says they don't exist. Not male and female friendships. Let him make his case then. Pastor Tom Baker will be our guest, host of Law and Gospel, and will be teaching a Sunday school lesson on the Passion of Christ in Matthew chapter 27. Feel free to join us with your questions or your comments over the next 2 hours, or call in number 1-877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about post-millennium feminism, Cleta Mitchell, an attorney in Washington, D.C., and author of a recent column for the New York Times titled No Room for Dissent in Women's Movement Today. Cleta, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. It's nice to be with you.
What first attracted you to the women's movement, and how deep did your involvement go initially?
Well, I was thinking back about that. I was a student at the University of Oklahoma, Norman, Oklahoma, and I was a student member of a task force which had the longest name of any committee I think I've ever served on, and I've served on a lot of committees since then. But it was the Committee to Study Inequality in the Pay Structure of the University System. And it was an effort to compare salaries of male and female professors and to try to make sure that it was a comparing apples and apples instead of apples and oranges. So it took tenure, it took class teaching load, publications, you know, and then compared the salaries of male and women faculty members. And that would have been in about 1970, 71. So it's a pretty long time ago. And I was a student member of this committee, and the committee issued its report, and then the committee was then asked to make a presentation about the report at the state legislature, which is the University of Oklahoma is about 30 miles south of Oklahoma City, where the state capital is. And so the committee decided that I should go make the presentation. And what we did find that comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges, that women faculty members tended to have to be compensated less than their male counterparts of equal stature. And so I was sent to the Capitol to make this presentation. And that was my first experience with at the state Capitol, other than when I was in the fourth grade and had gone there for, you know, Oklahoma history. And so I started spending some time there, sitting in the committee meetings, you know, making the presentation to the committee, sitting in the gallery, talking to legislators, and I just started becoming interested in what are the areas of law that treat men and women differently. And I then, in the course of time, went to law school, and so I just began to study the 19th century suffrage movement, and just begin to really try to understand the sort of history of the legal status of women in the United States since its inception. And I just did that all on my own as both an undergraduate and then continuing on through law school.
So, Cleta, when did things begin to change for you with respect to the women's movement?
Well, I would say that, you know, I spent the next 10 years or so. I was elected to the legislature. I was involved in the effort to for ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, I actually had written a paragraph about this in my essay and then had to cut it for space. But, you know, Phyllis Schlafly was, you know, I thought was our nemesis. And over time, you know, Phyllis became a very good friend of mine. I was able to tell her many times before she passed away last year that she was right all along. But toward the end of the 70s and the early 80s, really the end of the 70s, I was actually thinking about this question just the other day. In 1978, there was this thing called the International Women's Year Conference, which was held in Houston. And every state was supposed to elect delegates to this International Women's Year Conference. And I remember that Phyllis Schlafly and the Eagle Forum really organized in Oklahoma, and the delegation was pretty much comprised of Phyllis's people, which actually turned out, in my view, even at the time, I thought, well, you know, boy, we dodged a bullet, because this International Women's Year came out with all of these proposals or resolutions that had things like abortion on demand and homosexual rights and things like that. The nuclear freeze was ongoing at the time, and so they had a resolution on that. And I remember just being horrified and appalled, saying, wait a minute, this is getting pretty far afield of making sure that we have equal legal rights under the law. And I was actually asked by the White House, and President Carter's office called me and asked me if I would co-chair a president's commission, the President's Commission on Women. And this would have been in 78 or 79. And I thought about it, and I said, who's the other co-chair? And they said, Congresswoman Bella Abzug. Well, I had a lot of respect for Bella. I mean, she was a congresswoman and all, but I said, look, you know, why me? And they said, well, Mrs. Carter thought that you would be a good counterbalance to Bella Abzug. I said, well, I just had this vision of being on a teeter-totter with Bella at the bottom and me kind of at the top, you know, with my little legs dangling. I said, you know, this is not an equal assignment. And I declined to serve. And the person who was in charge of President Carter's Office of women's rights or whatever called and yelled at me, called me a redneck, and said it was people like me that were causing women to be held back. And, you know, I remember saying to her, you know, look, I just think that some of these issues that have been adopted by the International Women's Year Conference are not things that I can support. I don't think that that's what people, women in Oklahoma, are concerned about, and that's who I'm concerned about. So I refused, and she yelled at me, and I think that toward the end of the Carter administration is about when I realized that I didn't really want to much have anything to do with it anymore.
Where did the issue of abortion enter the picture?
Well, like I said, it began to enter the picture in the late 70s. But this is the irony of it all. This is the irony. Tell me why it is that after the Supreme Court made that decision, that it seems to me, and as we heard Judge Gorsuch say in his confirmation hearings, Roe v. Wade is, quote, settled law, unquote. So why then did it become necessary for the women's movement to even concern itself with that issue any longer? I mean, I don't understand that. I've never understood it, because it was settled law. But what I realized is that Roe v. Wade is not even the law of the land anymore. Now, remember, Roe v. Wade had a trimester construct where the Supreme Court created out of whole cloth that abortion in the first trimester could be neither regulated nor prohibited. During the second trimester, it could be regulated but not prohibited. And in the third trimester, it could be prohibited if the states chose to do so. Well, that isn't even the law in the United States, because the Supreme Court has expanded that first trimester analysis to abortions that are held on the at the very end. I mean, late term abortion is essentially allowed, even when it's not supposed to be. So I actually have wondered if someone needs to do the research. The Planned Parenthood facility in Oklahoma City in the 1970s and 80s did not even perform abortions. It really was for family planning and to help women with contraception and that kind of thing. Abortion was not something that facility, that chapter, even did. But now I understand that that's not an option for local Planned Parenthood affiliates. And I think it must have to do with money and this notion that somehow women are supposed to be able to make a decision like that without any interference from anyone, without ever stopping to think that they are not just making a decision about their own life, but they're making a decision about the life of another. And I think that there just came to be a view somehow that it was part of almost a Marxist philosophy where life has no meaning. And I just find it a very disturbing, and I came to find it just very disturbing.
Cleta Mitchell is our guest, an attorney in Washington, D.C., and author of a recent column for the New York Times titled No Room for Dissent in Women's Movement Today. We're talking about post-millennium feminism, and we'll be right back.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The fake news wars that we're experiencing right now are not going to end soon.
Terry Mattingly on his presentation at this summer's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, making the case for news discernment.
We're actually seeing a war to define what is and what isn't news. This whole thing is about the purpose of journalism and whether the classic American model of the press, with its whole emphasis on balance and fairness, is going to survive the internet age. What we'll be talking about is where savvy readers can go to get their news. We're also going to ask, what happens to American public discourse if we all keep on clicking on news sources that only tell us what we want to hear?
You can meet and hear Terry Mattingly June 9th and 10th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, just look for the Making the Case logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 618-223-8385. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about post-millennium feminism with Cleta Mitchell, an attorney in Washington, D.C. You won't find any post-millennial feminism in the new audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically. It's voiced by the book's authors, Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel. You can purchase an audio version of Ladylike at Amazon, at Audible, and at iTunes. Cleta, the women's movement as you knew it, you say that these goals that were set there, equal pay and equal legal rights and other things, they got it. They got it all big time.
We did. Those laws, those antiquated laws that were part of the American legal structure that came from the English common law, you know, our law other than the state of Louisiana is all arises from the British common law. And under the British common law, women literally were treated in the same legal categories as children and insane persons. I mean, the whole story behind Pride and Prejudice is that there are these daughters that they have to get married off, because if none of the daughters get married, then the estate, when the father dies, will go to a cousin. And because women, girls, were not allowed to inherit, they'd have to be married and could only inherit through their husbands. Well, that basic view of women under the law came to the United States, and there were laws, many laws on the books in the early 70s still, that were vestiges of that old common law history, where women couldn't serve on juries, and they couldn't be licensed as attorneys, and they couldn't be licensed as physicians, and they weren't allowed in a lot of the schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that all changed. It all changed in the 70s, and yet we're never supposed to declare victory. We're never allowed to say, we won. There are no laws that keep us from doing whatever we want to do. There are laws that do some things that maybe we didn't intend. I don't think Title IX was ever intended to mean that schools had to abolish men's baseball or wrestling in order to even things out. So I think that we make a mistake. Any movement makes a mistake when it is unable to look at its achievements and to say, maybe we're an anachronism now. Maybe we don't need to continue to try to act as though we have a lot of work left to do, when really the women's movement has no reason to exist at this point. The women's movement, as I understood it and participated in it.
So what you're saying there was the goal should have always been to make a women's movement unnecessary by reforming those laws or eliminating those laws and structures. They did it. You just said a moment ago that declaring victory, this is a movement that refuses to declare victory. You even say in your article that that's considered unforgivable.
It is. It is. You're not supposed to say that we won. You're never supposed to say that. Now, frankly, I think that a lot of the leftist, quote, movements, I think that's true for a lot of them. I think the labor movement, for instance, has outlived its usefulness. You know, it began as a movement to secure safe working conditions and that kind of thing, and economic advancement. And I think that it has done all of those things. And in many cases, now unions exist to file grievances if some lousy worker gets disciplined or fired. I don't think that's what was intended. And I think to some degree, the civil rights movement is the same thing. We have the same thing. If I think about, if I don't know how old you are, but I know certainly thinking about watching the march and Dr. Martin Luther King's speech from at the Lincoln Memorial in the 1960s, and to see what has happened since then. And now it's almost as though, I mean, the people who lead that movement just simply cannot declare victory and cannot say, okay, the next step is for individuals to make good choices and to prepare themselves to take advantage of the opportunities that they now have. And I think that that's really the point, is that at some point, it's no longer the government's responsibility to guarantee equal outcomes. All the government can do is to create a legal structure to provide equal opportunities. That's what affirmative action was supposed to be. That's what all of these things were supposed to be. It was an opportunity program. It wasn't a guaranteed outcome program, and it wasn't ever intended to be a movement, at least not in my mind, to ensure that people who didn't deserve to be successful or who didn't deserve to do whatever it was they wanted to do, that somehow they would be able to achieve anyway. I think it comes down to being able to have the opportunities, and then it's up to us as individuals to prepare ourselves to take advantage of those.
Is the women's movement, or as you call it, post-millennium feminism, is it still about choice?
No. Oh, well, it depends. Only if you make choices that are deemed acceptable. So if you want to be a partner in a law firm or on the Supreme Court or a doctor or whatever, you want to go to medical school or law school or whatever, that's great. And they're all for it, and women's networks to support you. But if you want to take a break from being a lawyer and go raise your kids because you can't figure out how to work 70 hours a week at the law firm and take care of your children, and so you take a break, well, the law firms just tie themselves into knots trying to figure out how to keep that from happening. Well, you know what? Here's the one thing the women's movement has never been able to provide, and that is more than 24 hours in a day. So you have to set priorities, and women set priorities that include, or should set priorities that include, taking care of their children. And I think that it's really difficult. I know that it's really difficult for a woman in a service business of any kind to be able, it's a very difficult balancing act. But I don't think the government can fix that unless the government can figure out a way to add hours to the day. They may move the day, the hours around in the day, but there's still only 24 hours in the day.
You write, the ugly truth is that the women's movement has morphed into a giant abortion rights lobby demanding abortion far beyond Roe v. Wade trimester structure. You talked about that latter part of that statement, but talk about its change into essentially an abortion rights lobby.
Well, I would just ask people to look at who the speakers were at those women's marches and everything, you know, those ridiculous pink hats that they were wearing. I mean, everything has revolved around abortion. And, you know, there were pro-life groups that sought to co-sponsor the march in Washington and were first accepted. And when it was learned that they were a pro-life group, their money was returned and they were politely ejected. And you had people like Angela Davis and Madonna and Ashley Judd and Cecile Richards. I mean, Cecile Richard is really the face of whatever women's movement there is today. She's the head of Planned Parenthood. And the fact is, in the final analysis, that's what it's all about. If you compare the reaction by feminist leaders, I use that term very roughly, but there were no big women's marches over Bill Clinton and his sexual predatory behavior in the White House, his assaults against women, his sexual assaults of women, his sexual harassment of an intern in the White House. I mean, that's the kind of thing that gets you fired from my law firm, much less being the President of the United States. And did you see any women's marches demanding that he resign because of his mistreatment of women? No. The answer is no. And the reason was because he's pro-abortion. And as long as you're a pro-abortion man, you can get away with doing anything to women. But, you know, these groups said that they were marching to protest the election of Donald Trump because of some potty mouth radio interview he'd given 10 years earlier. Well, where was that same outrage as applied to Bill Clinton? Instead, what we had when Bill Clinton, when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, every Democratic woman in the United States Senate and in his cabinet went to the White House, met with him, and stood out in the White House driveway after the meeting and declared that it was all a lie, and they were defending him, that he had told them that it didn't happen, and they were demanding that the media and all, you know, quit picking on Bill Clinton. Well, not one of those women has since apologized for lying to the American people because he lied to them, and that goes for including his wife. I mean, Hillary Clinton was an enabler, has been an enabler of Bill Clinton's predatory sexual misconduct for decades. And they're all crying and twisting their arms and wringing their hands because Hillary Clinton, this great proponent of women, didn't get elected president. I'm not sure how she's more of a proponent of women than Donald Trump. In my view, Donald Trump is a greater proponent of women than Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's primary effort to promote women was promoting herself. So I know that that was what the genesis of these marches was, the outrage that Hillary Clinton lost and Donald Trump won. But I just would say, look at this movement. It is totally disingenuous. It is totally built on a lie. If you are pro-abortion, you're forgiven anything. And if you are pro-life, you are accused and found guilty of anything and everything as a slight to women.
In that vein, and since you mentioned the White House, Kellyanne Conway has achieved probably what would have been considered impossible at the beginning of the women's movement, or at that point of the women's movement where you joined it, essentially a chief advisor to the President of the United States. And, you know, without riding anyone's coattails, to tell you the truth, essentially got Donald Trump elected and is now serving in the White House. Why does post-millennium feminism not only not give her any credit for that, but regularly vilify her?
Because she's pro-life. I think that is exactly why it's the same basis on which they vilified Sarah Palin. It had nothing to do with anything other than that. That you, if you are a pro-life woman, they want to bury you because you are considered to be a traitor to the cause if you are pro-life. And my reaction to that is, think of all those millions of baby girls who've been aborted and killed who never had the opportunity to achieve anything, and all the things, all the opportunities that have been hard won because they were terminated before they were allowed to live. Now, to me, that is turning on women, turning in by promoting that kind of barbaric, horrible misconduct. But Kellyanne Conway will never get the adoration and the emulation that she has earned, that was given to Hillary Clinton, to Michelle Obama, to Valerie Jarrett, because they hooked themselves to some male person who achieved high office. Kellyanne Conway, she was the one responsible, certainly helped to be one of the ones responsible for Donald Trump's election. But she's a pro-life conservative woman. And women's leaders, feminist leaders, can't stand that.
Finally, then, is is post-millennium feminism really about advancing women from the various ills in society and social ills, political ills that they may still face?
I don't think so. I really think it is just about abortion on demand. And as I said, it's not even within the construct of Roe versus Wade. Because if that were all they were trying to protect, that is settled law. But the abortion lobby, which is the feminist movement such as it is, they want no restrictions, no regulations, no protections. There is a greater outcry about Donald Trump's media interview, about former Representative Todd Akin's media interview. There's outrage about that, but there was never outrage about Bill Clinton. There was never the same kind of outrage about Kermit Gosnell, who was the abortionist in Philadelphia, who was finally convicted of murder, 7 counts of murder. He should have been convicted of many thousands more. Horrible, horrible situation. Just a modern-day Mengele. Had nothing on this guy, the former Nazi. And where was the women's movement? Where were feminist leaders demanding that he be imprisoned, that he be charged? They weren't the ones who made sure that to put him behind bars, and they did nothing. They've done nothing to say, we need to make sure that nobody else is doing this kind of thing anywhere in America. They state that it isn't happening and that it won't happen and can't happen, and they fight every regulation that would protect women. I don't know how they can say that they're trying to protect women when all they do is protect the abortion industry itself, the money-making end of killing babies. I don't find that to be a very compelling movement in which to be participating in this point in my life or anyone's life.
One more question occurs to me, Cleta. Is there still a place where the women's movement as you knew it is still alive, still exists?
I don't really think so, because we won. Somebody asked me this question during the day of the Women's March was, can anyone identify a right, a legal right that men have that women don't have in America today? And I said, no, I can't. I mean, I couldn't think of any. Now, should there be women's marches in other countries, in Islamic countries, largely Muslim countries? You bet, because, you know, look at their treatment of women. And yet, one of the featured speakers at the women's march was some Islamic leader. So it makes absolutely no sense. If there's a place for the women's movement, it would be internationally to fight for the rights of women in countries whose laws still very much oppress women. And yes, there are many of those countries around the world. And yes, should we strengthen laws against human trafficking and those kinds of things? Yes, we should. And it's important to focus on those things. But in terms of just, do the laws of the United States treat women in a negatively discriminatory manner in 2017, I would say the answer is no. Those laws don't exist anymore.
Cleta Mitchell is an attorney in Washington, D.C., author of a recent column for the New York Times titled No Room for Dissent in Women's Movement Today. Read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Cleta, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Cheryl Magnus is with us on the other side of the break. We're going to talk with her about two issues. Practicing the Benedict option, she says that she and her husband family have been doing so for 20 years without even knowing it, and preparing for Easter. Stay tuned.
We would like to overlook the difficulty of daily repentance and death to our sins in the interest of progressing to a more advanced spirituality.
Rebecca Curtis from her new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Somehow, spiritual advancement always amounts to our getting to spend more time on the things we like and calling it stewardship or service.
You can purchase and download an audio version of Ladylike, Living Biblically at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. Ladylike, Living Biblically by Rebecca Curtis and Rose Adel.
I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Tired of mommy bloggers telling you Lent is about simplifying your life? Totally over the History Channel speculating on whether or not Jesus' skin was olive or white? Check out the April the Lutheran Witness. We're talking Lent, Easter, and Jesus, who hangs on a cross for you, lies in a tomb for you, and is risen and returning all for you. Visit cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness for a special offer of 6 issues for $6.99. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Dr. Anthony Eslin will be speaking on the topic of imagination and education at the second annual Wittenberg Academy Family Retreat, which will be held at Camp Okoboji in Milford, Iowa on April 27th through the 29th, 2017. Join us and be immersed in God's Word, thoughtful discussions, and family fun. For more information or to register, visit www.wittenbergacademy.org and click on the registration tab.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as Confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the CLCC.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a Confessional Lutheran. The CLCC.org.